capital now, on the far side of the great mountain. Nick and the others were already hiking uphill through an ankle-high litter of bracken and scrub, weapons slung across their shoulders. The living wall of the jungle loomed 20 meters above. In the far distance, Mace could just make out a segmented line of gray blotches, probably tame grassers.
Master Windu!
Nick had stopped on the hillside above. He beckoned for Mace to follow and pointed at the sky.
Air patrols. We need to make the tree line.
Single file through the jungle. Chalk picked their path, parting gleam fronds, tipping grip-leaf trailers aside with the muzzle of the thunderbolt. Mace followed perhaps 10 meters back, with Nick close behind his shoulder. Besh and Lesh brought up the rear together, switching positions from time to time, covering each other. Mace had to look sharp to keep track of Chalk. Once they were well into the jungle, Mace could no longer easily feel any of the Coronai in the forest. Nor could he easily pick them out with ordinary senses. Some subtle force trick gave his gaze a tendency to slip aside from them and to pass over them without seeing unless he firmly directed his will. They broke out into a gap, and Nick called a halt. Chalk moved into the middle of the gap, lowered her head, and went entirely still. A force wave passed out from her and broke across Mace, and 35 years fell away. For a delicious instant, Mace was once more a boy, returned to the company of Gosh Windu after a lifetime in the Jedi Temple, feeling for the first time the silken warmth of a Korin's force call to an Ankh. Within minutes, a crashing outside the gap heralded the arrival of large beasts, and soon the jungle wall parted to admit a grasser. It lumbered into the gap on its hind legs, its four anterior limbs occupied with ripping down greenery and stuffing it into a mouth large enough to swallow Mace whole. It chewed placidly, bovine contentment in all three of its eyes. Three more grassers tore their way into the gap. All four were harnessed for riding, the wide saddles cinched above and below their foreshoulders, exactly as Mace remembered. One wore a dual saddle setup, the secondary saddle slung reversed at the beast's mid-shoulder. Nick reached up to take the knotted mounting rope of the dual-saddled grasser.
Come on, Master Windu. You're riding with me.
Where are your axes?
Around. Can't you feel them?
And now Mace could. A ring of predatory wariness outside the green walls. Savagery and hunger and devotion tangled into a semi-sentient knot of let's find something to kill. Nick rope-walked up the flank of the grasser and slid into the upper saddle.
You'll see them if you need to see them. Let's hope you don't.
Is it no longer customary to introduce a guest to the axe of the Gosh?
Without even understanding why he did it, Mace moved away into the middle of the gap. One breath composed his mind. The next expressed his nature into the force around him. Jedi serenity balancing buried temper. Devotion to peace tipping the scales against a guilty pleasure in fighting. Nothing was hidden here. Light and dark, pure and corrupt, hope, fear, pride and humility. He offered up everything that made him who he was, with friendly smile and lowered eye and hands open at his sides. Then he sent rippling through the force the call he'd been taught 35 years before, and he got an answer. Slipping through the walls of the gap, measured tread blending seamlessly with wind rustle and insect buzz. Horned, reptoid heads questing, lidless oval eyes of gleaming black.
Windu!
A hiss from Nick.
Don't move!
Triangular fangs scissored along each other as jaws that could crush durasteel worked and chewed. Steaming drool trailed down mouthfolds of scaled hide thick enough to stop a lightsaber. Splay-toed feet with shovel-sized claws churned kilos of soil with every step. Muscular armored tails, as long as their landspeeder-sized bodies, whipped sinuously back and forth. The Ackdogs of Harun Kal. Three of them. They circled, switching tails that could break Mace in half. Their eyes, hard-shelled and lidless, glittered without expression. Nick stared down at Mace from 3 meters above the jungle floor.
Don't just stand there!
All right. Mace lifted his hands and all three act dogs lay down. A touch on the force and a turn of both palms and the three dogs rolled onto their backs, black tongues lolling to the side between razor-sharp teeth. They panted happily, gazing at him with absolute trust. Nick said something about dipping himself in Tusker poop. Mace moved to one dog's head, sliding the palm of his hand between the triangle that six vestigial horns formed on the axe brow. His other hand he placed just beside the axe lower lip, so that the creature's huge tongue could flick Mace's scent into the olfactory pits beside his nostrils. He moved from one to the next, and then to the last. They took his scent, and he took their force field. With the severe formality such solemn occasions demand, they respectfully learned each other. "All right," Mace said, to everyone and no one. "I'm ready to go." Every night, they made a cold camp. No fire, and no need for one. The axe would keep predators at bay, and the Corps and I did not mind the darkness. Though militia gunships did not fly at night, a campfire was enough hotter than the surrounding jungle that it could be detected by satellite sensors. Nick explained dryly that you never know when the Balawai might decide to drop a dokaw on your head. He said that the government still had an unknown number of dokaw platforms in orbit. The deorbiting kinetic anti-emplacement weapons were basically just missile-sized rods of solid durasteel with rudimentary guidance and control systems set in orbit around the planet. Not too accurate, but then it didn't have to be. A meteorite strike on demand. For the Coronai, campfires were a thing of the past. They would sit or kneel on the ground, sharing their meals. Once the food squares and candy they'd looted from the dead men ran out, their meals became strips of smoked grasser meat and a hard, cave-edged cheese made from raw grasser milk. Mace learned a great deal about these young Coronai, and, by implication, about the ULF, during these nights in camp. Nick was the leader of this little band, but not by any reason of rank. They didn't seem to have ranks. Nick led by force of personality and by lightning use of his acid wit, like a jester in control of a royal court. Lesh and Besh were in the war from stark hatred of the Balawai. A couple of years before, Besh had been kidnapped by jungle prospectors. His missing fingers had been cut off, one at a time, by the Balawai, to force him to answer questions about the location of a supposed treasure grove of Lammas trees. When he could not answer these questions, in fact, the treasure grove was only a myth. They assumed he was just stubborn. "If you won't answer us," one had said, "we'll make sure you never answer anyone else either." Besh never spoke because he couldn't. The Balawai had cut out his tongue. Chalk proved a surprise to Mace. Guessing what he had of what had happened to her, he expected that she would be fighting out of a personal vendetta, not unlike Lesh and Besh. On the contrary, even before joining the ULF, she and some members of her gauche had hunted down the men who'd molested her, a five-man squad of regular militia and their non-com, and given them the traditional Korin punishment for such crimes. This was called Tan Peltrukal, which roughly translates as jungle justice. The guilty men were kidnapped, spirited away 100 kilometers from the nearest settlement, then stripped of equipment, clothing, food, everything, and released, naked, in the jungle. Very, very few men had ever survived Tan Peltrukal. These didn't. So Chalk did not fight for revenge. In her own words, "Tough girl me, big, strong, good fighter. Didn't want to be, had to be." "I am impressed by how you move through the jungle," May said to her once, in one of these cold camps. "It's not easy to see you, even when I know you're there. Even your grasser is hard to track." She grunted, chewing bark. Her dismissive shrug was about as casual as Mace's question. That is, not very. "That's an interesting way of using..." He dredged from the depths of his 35-year-old memory the Korun word for the force. Pelikotan. Roughly, world power. "Using Pelikotan. Is this something you've always been able to do?" What Mace was really asking, what he was afraid to ask outright, did Deepa teach you that? If she was teaching Jedi skills to people who were too old to learn Jedi discipline, people with no defense against the dark side. You don't use Pelikotan, Chalk said. Pelikotan uses you. This was not a comforting answer. Mace recalled that the strict, literal translation of the word was jungle mind. He discovered that he didn't really want to think about it. In his head, he kept hearing,
I have become the darkness in the jungle.
The grasser's lumbering pace was smooth and soothing. To make better time, it walked on both hind and mid-limbs. This put its back at such an angle that Mace's rear-facing saddle let him recline somewhat, his shoulders resting on the grasser's broad, smooth spine, while Nick rode the foreshoulder saddle, peering over the top of its head. During the day, he saw the Ack dogs in glimpses through the jungle as they ranged the rugged terrain. They went before and behind, patrolling to guard the humans from jungle predators, of which these jungles hid many that were large enough to kill a grasser. The three Acks were bonded to Besh, Lesh, and Chalk. Nick had no Ack of his own. Day travel was a dreamlike flow, from jungle gloom to brilliant sun and back again. As they crossed grasser roads, the winding strips of open meadow left behind by grasser herds as they ate their way through the jungle. These were often the only times he'd see Chalk and Besh and Lesh, their grassers and their Acks. Using the Ack dogs to keep in contact, they could spread out for safety. Though they could have moved faster by following the grasser roads, frequent overflights by militia gunships made that too risky. Nick informed him that men riding grassers were shot on sight. Every hour or two, the Ax gave warning of approaching gunships. Their keen ears could pick up the hum of repulsor lifts from over a kilometer away. Despite the jungle's constant buzz and rustle, whir and screech, and even the distant thunder of the occasional minor volcanic eruption. Mace got enough glimpses of these gunships to have an idea of their capabilities. They looked to be customized versions of ancient Sinar turbostorms, blast boats retrofitted for atmospheric close assault work. Relatively slow, but heavily armored, bristling with cannons and missile launchers, large enough to transport a platoon of heavy infantry. They seemed to travel in threes. May stood in a universe of rain. As though the jungle trees and ferns and flowers had grown at the foot of a towering waterfall, rain pounded through leaf and branch with a roar that made conversation possible only in shouts. Visibility was only a handful of meters. It was just barely good enough that he could see the corpses. They hung upside down, elbows bent at a strange angle because their hands were still tied behind them. Mace counted 7 bodies. Birds and insects had been at them as well as the vine cats. They'd been hanging for a while. Through the colorless tatters that were all that remained of their clothing, it was impossible to tell even if they had been men or women. Mace was only moderately certain that they had been human. He stood beneath them, looking up into the empty eye sockets of the two that still had heads.
Is this what you felt? Nick shouted down from the saddle.
Mace nodded. Echoes of these murders howled in the force around him. He'd been able to feel it from hundreds of meters away. This place stank of the dark side. We should bury them.
We should get out of here!
What?
Mount up, we're leaving.
We can't just leave them for the scavengers.
Sure we can, and we will!
Nick leaned down toward Mace, and on his face was something that might have even been pity.
If those are Koronai, to give them any kind of decent burial will only light a giant "we were here" advertiscreen for the next band of irregulars or militia patrol, and give them a pretty good idea of when. If those are Balawai...
He glanced up at them. Everything human left his face. He lowered his voice, but Mace could read his lips.
If they're Balawai, he muttered, this is already better than they deserve.
day. They were exposed in a notch pass through a razorback ridge. Some long-ago groundquake had knocked a gap here. Nick reined in their grasser.
Lesh is in trouble.
He wheeled the grasser and they galloped back through the notch. From Mace's rear-facing saddle, he watched Chalk overtaking them on her way back from her position on point. Her grasser was the fastest of the four, and it carried only half the load of Nick's. On the descending curve of the pass, someone was down. An ack dog nosed him nervously. Lesh. Lesh was in convulsions. His face had twisted into a rigid mask, a blind gape at the empty afternoon sky. He bucked and writhed, hands clutching spastically, heels drumming the rocks. Dropping to a knee, Mace reached for the medpack scanner. Chalk said, "Leave it." Mace looked up at her. She gave him the head shake. Dead already. Mace picked up the scanner anyway and slid the medpack cover open to activate the display. Lesh was infected. Unidentified blood-borne parasites had collected in his central nervous system. They had now entered a new stage in their life cycle. They were eating his brain.
"Fever wasps,"
Nick said hoarsely. He was almost as pale as Besh.
"No telling when he might have been stung. Thistle chewers go faster. The larvae like the bark. When they hatch..."
He swallowed and his eyes went thin. He had to look away.
"They'll hatch from his skull. Through his skull. Like an eggshell."
The pure, uncomplicated horror on his face told Mace this wouldn't be the first time he'd seen it happen. "The medpack says he can still be saved." It took only a second to charge a spray hypo with thanatazine. "We can put him in suspended animation. Slow down the wasp larvae. Until we can get him to Pelic Baw in a full hospital. Even if he's identified..." Besh looked up at him and shook his head in a mute no. Mace brushed past him and knelt at Lesh's side. "We can save him, Besh. Maybe it'll mean giving him up to the militia, but at least he'll be alive." Besh caught Mace's arm. His eyes were raw, spidered with blood. Again, he shook his head.
"Master Windu."
Nick picked up the medpack case and glanced at the readout.
"Lesh is way more advanced than this thing says."
"Medpack scanners are extremely reliable. I can't imagine it's wrong."
"It's not wrong," Nick says softly. He turned the case so that Mace could check the screen again.
"These aren't Lesh's readings."
"What?"
Besh, looking at the ground, touched his own chest with the tips of his fingers, then sagged. He seemed to crumple in on himself, breath leaving him along with hope and fear. His force aura shaded into black despair. Mace looked from Besh to Nick and back again, and then at Lesh spasming on the rocks, and then at the spray hypo still clutched nervelessly in his hand. "Not because the jungle kills you," Nick had said. "Just because it is what it is." Nick retrieved the medpack scanner and waved it near Mace's head.
"You're okay," he said thinly, licking pale sweat from his upper lip. "No sign of infestation."
He turned to Chalk, frowning down at the medpack's readout. His shoulders slumped and his hands started to shake. He had no words, but he didn't need any. She read her fate on his face. She stiffened and her mouth went thin and hard. Then she turned away and marched downslope. Nick turned his stricken look on Mace.
"Master Windu?"
He held out the medpack scanner imploringly.
"Don't make me do my own reading, huh?"
Mace quickly scanned Nick's spine and skull. The readings indicated a clear negative, but Nick didn't seem much relieved.
"Yeah, well," he said with understated bitterness. "If I was gonna die in the next day or two, I wouldn't have to worry about taking care of them."
"Taking care of them?" May said. "Is there a treatment?"
"Yeah."
Nick drew his pistol.
"I got the treatment right here."
"That's your answer?"
May stepped in front of him.
"Kill your friends?"
"Just Lesh,"
Nick said, his voice grim and hard, even though it trembled a little, like his hand.
time enough to take care of Besh and Chalk when they start the twitches. Mace still couldn't believe Nick was serious.
You want to just shoot them?
Nick's face had gone gray. Not in the head. Scatters the larvae. Some of them will be developed enough to be dangerous. To us.
So, it's not enough that he dies.
Mace breathed Jedi discipline into a wall around his heart, to lock down his empathic horror at the gray rictus of Lesh's face. Pink-tinged foam bubbled from Lesh's lips.
The infested areas have to be destroyed. Brain and spinal cord.
Nick nodded, looking even sicker. With wasp fever, we usually burn the body. But...
Mace understood.
He unclipped the lightsabers from his belt. His own and Deepa's both. Green blade and purple sizzled together in the smoke-hazed air. Besh looked up from the ground. Chalk went still on the slope, the thunderbolt cradled in her arms. Nick opened his mouth as though he wanted to say something, but didn't know what it might be. They all stared at Mace as though they'd never seen him before.
He's your friend. Your brother.
Mace took a deep breath, steadying his own fear and revulsion, and his dark, dark loathing for what he must do.
You might want to say goodbye.
The Razorback Ridge eclipsed the southern sky behind them. The jungle canopy overhead glowed with early sunset. On the ground, it was already twilight. The companions walked along a broad track crushed bare by repeated passages of steam crawler treads. What was left of Lesh was buried at the tree line. They pushed on. Nick had not spoken since a gunship attack had killed all their grassers and two of their acts. Mace matched Nick's pace, close by his side.
Talk to me.
Nick's eyes stayed on the jungle ahead. Why should I?
Because I want to know what you have in mind.
What makes you think I have anything in mind? What makes you think anything I might have in mind can make a difference? His voice was angrily bitter. We have two people about to go into second stage wasp fever. No grasses, one ack, a handful of weapons, militia on our tail, and you and me. His gaze slid sideways to meet Mace's. His eyes were red and raw. We're dead. You get it? We didn't make it. We're dead.
For dead men, Mace observed, we're making good time.
For an instant, he thought Nick might crack a smile. Instead, Nick shook his head.
There's a Lord Pellick who travels with Deepa's band. He's very powerful. More than powerful. If we can get Besh and Chalk to him before they start the twitches, he might be able to save them.
Lord Pellick. Jungle master. Shaman. Witch doctor. Wizard.
In Korin legend, the Lord Pellick was a man of great power and great peril. As unpredictable as the jungle, he brings life or death, a gift or a wound. In some stories, a Lord Pellick is not a man at all, but is rather the Pellicotan incarnate, the avatar of the jungle mind.
Mace made a connection. Kar Vastor.
Nick goggled at him.
How'd you know that? How'd you know his name?
Deepa mentioned him in one of her transmissions. How long before we reach them?
Nick trudged on a few paces before he answered.
If we still had grassers and axe for warding, maybe 2 days, maybe less. On foot, with only one axe?
His shrug was expressive.
Then why march us so hard?
Mace asked.
Because I do have something in mind.
He flicked a sidelong glance at Mace.
But you're not gonna like it.
Nick's gaze went remote, staring off into the gloom-filled tunnel ahead.
There's a little outpost settlement about an hour west of here. Ones like it are strung out every 100K or so along these steamcrawler tracks. They'll have a secure bunker and a comm unit. Even though we, the ULF, don't use comm, we still monitor the frequencies. We get in there, we can send a coded signal to them with our position. Then, we put Chalk and Besh in phenatazine suspension, sit tight, and hope for the best.
A Balawai settlement?
Nick nodded. Mace's face darkened.
I won't let you harm civilians, not even to save your friends.
No need to scorch your scalp over that one, Nick said, trudging onward. Out here, civilians are a myth.
From the private journals of Mace Windu.
In this bunker, the air is closer to cool than any I've felt since the interrogation room in the Ministry of Justice. The bunker is set into the igneous stone of the hillside, mostly just a durasteel door across the mouth of a bubble some pocket of gas or softer stone had left in the granite here. Though it overlooks the remnants of the outpost compound below, it was clearly never meant to be a combat position. No gun ports. From the way it's constructed, excavated, I believe it was more along the lines of a panic room. A safe place to hole up in the event of an attack. A safe place to wait for help from the militia. If so, it didn't work. The night air gently curls around the twisted shards that are all that's left of the door. Its whispering passage darkly echoes the violence that still hums in the force around me. I dare not meditate. The dark is too deep here. It has a tidal pull, a black hole that I've taken up too tight an orbit around, and it's tearing me in half. Gravity draws the near half of me in toward an event horizon, which I'm afraid to even glimpse. Behind me, lost in the night shadows against the stone, Besh and Chalk lie motionless, near as cool as the rock they lie on, in full phenatazine suspension. Only with the force can I tell that they still live. Their hearts beat less than once per minute, and an hour spans no more than 10 or 12 shallow breaths. The fever wasp larvae in their bodies are similarly suspended. Besh and Chalk might survive a week or more like this. The thunderbolt rests on its bipod in the doorway, muzzle canted toward the sky. There is little for me to do right now. I pass the time by recording this and by thinking about my argument with Nick. Back on the trail, Nick said that civilians are a myth. He meant, I found, that there are no civilians out here, that to be in the jungle is to be in the war. The Balawai government promulgates a myth of innocent jungle prospectors being massacred by savage Koronai partisans. This, Nick says, is only propaganda. According to Nick, civilians stay in the cities. The only real civilians on Harun Kaul are the waiters and the janitors, the storekeepers and the taxi cart pullers. Then I asked him about the dead children. It's the only time I've yet seen Nick angry. He wheeled on me like he wanted to throw a punch. "What children?" he said. "How old do you have to be to pull a trigger? Kids make great soldiers. They barely know what fear is." It is wrong to make war on children or with them, and I told them so. No matter what, they're not old enough to understand the consequences of their actions. He replied in staggeringly obscene terms that I should tell that to the Balawai. It has occurred to me on reflection that Nick Rostu can be regarded as a test of my moral conviction. A Jedi might conceivably fall to the dark from the simple desire to smack the stuffing out of him. At the time, I managed to restrain myself, and even to maintain a civil tone, while Nick revealed that he knew all about the jungle massacre and the data crystal. It wasn't easy. He told me that not only had he been there, at the very scene Yoda and I had seen in Palpatine's office, he had been in the company of Deepa and Carvaster when they'd thought the whole scheme up. He had helped them dress the scene, and later it was Nick himself who had tipped off Republic Intelligence. Even now, hours later, it's hard for me to put into words how that made me feel. Disoriented, certainly. Almost dizzy. Disbelieving. Betrayed. It is as well that Nick left on Chalk's Ak-Dog Galthra some hours ago. Perhaps before he returns, if he returns, I will have found a place in my mind to put these things he shared with me, where they will no longer whisper violence behind my heart. The whole massacre was staged. Not fake. The bodies were real. The death was real. But it was a setup. It was a practical joke. On me. Deepa wanted me here. That's what this had been about from the beginning. That data crystal wasn't a frame, and it wasn't a confession. It was a lure. She wanted to draw me from Coruscant, bring me to Harun Kaul, and drop me into this nightmare jungle. Many of the corpses were indeed jungle prospectors, Nick told me. Jups, when they're not harvesting the jungle, act as irregulars for the Balawai militia. The rest of the corpses in that staged little scene, they were Koronai prisoners, captured by the Jups. Captured and tortured and maltreated beyond my ability to describe. When the ULF caught up, the first thing the Balawai did was execute the few prisoners who were still alive. Nick tells me that none of them escaped, none of the prisoners, and none of the Jups. The children. The children were Koronai. This Carvaster, what kind of man must he be? Nick told me it was Carvaster who nailed that data crystal into the dead woman's mouth with brass vine thorns. Nick told me it was Carvaster who persuaded the ULF to leave the corpses in the jungle, to make the scene so gruesome that I'd be sure to come here to investigate. To leave dead children. Their own dead children. To the Jacunas and the screw maggots. And the black, stinking carrion flies so full of blood they can only waddle across rotting flesh. Stop. I have to stop. Stop talking about this. Stop thinking about it. I can't. This isn't. I'm afraid that the man I was would despise the man I am becoming. I have a terrible dread that this transformation is exactly what Deepa had in mind when she decided to draw me here. She said, there is nothing more dangerous than a Jedi who's finally gone sane. I think she is dangerous. I'm afraid she wants me to become dangerous, too. Nick says, the words on that crystal are just how Deepa talks now. He says she has nightmares, that screams from her tent tear through the camp. He says no one ever sees her eat, that she's wasting away as though something inside is instead eating her. He says she has headaches that painkillers cannot touch, and sometimes cannot leave her tent for days at a time. I'm sorry I asked. I'm sorry that Nick told me. I'm sorry that he did not lie. It is very un-Jedi to fear the truth. I'll continue the story. Putting experience into words is a gain in perspective, which I need, and it's a way to pass the hours of the night, which I also need. This outpost settlement was built at the crest of a shoulder sloping down from the ridge. The ridge here isn't a razorback anymore, but rather a sine wave wall of volcanic mounds. The settlement stands on a green splashed outcrop. To either side of this jungle-clutched fist of stone are blackened washes where lava occasionally flows down from a major caldera, which is about 600 meters above where I sit and record this. If you listen closely, you might hear the rumble. This microphone may not be sensitive enough. There. Hear that? It's ramping up for another eruption. The bunker itself is slightly elevated above the rest of the compound. From where I sit, in the wreckage of the doorway, I can look down over a charred mass of tumbled and broken prefab huts and the shattered perimeter wall. Pale glowvine light shows gray on the steam crawler track that switchbacks up the side of the shoulder. The ULF had been here already. There were no survivors. Based on the limited scavenger damage and the low decomposition, Nick guessed that the ULF band who'd done this might have passed through here no more than 2 or 3 days before. The ULF guerrillas also thoroughly looted this place. There was not a scrap of food to be found, and only useless bits and pieces of technology and equipment. The comm gear is gone as well, of course, which is why I alone am here to watch over Besh and Chalk. When we found the comm gear gone, Nick's spirits collapsed. Bad luck, he muttered under his breath. Just bad luck. Luck, I told him softly, does not exist. Luck is only a word we use to describe our blindness to the subtle currents of the Force. His response was bitter. Yeah? What subtle current killed Lesh? Is this what your force had planned for you? For Besh and Chalk? The Jedi say, I replied, that there are questions to which we can never have answers. We can only be answers. He asked me angrily what that was supposed to mean. I told him, I am neither a scientist nor a philosopher. I am a Jedi. I don't have to explain reality. I just have to deal with it. He said, you have a Jedi power that can get all of us to Deepa and Kar in a day, or three. They're marching away from us. We can't catch up. That's reality. The only one there is. Is it? I let a thoughtful gaze rest on Gothra's broad back. She moves well through this jungle. I know that axes are not beasts of burden, but one man, alone, she might be able to carry at great speed. Well, yeah, if I didn't have to worry about you guys. Nick stopped, his eyes narrowed. Not a chance, Windu, drop it. I stepped close to him. Nick had to bend his neck to look up into my eyes. I'm not arguing with you, Nick, and I'm not asking you. This is not a discussion. It's a briefing. Nick is a stubborn young man, but he's not stupid. It didn't take him long to understand that until he met me, he didn't know what stubborn looks like. We managed to rig an improvised bareback pad for Gothra. Nick and Chalk and I persuaded Gothra, through the Force, to bear Nick on her back and carry him swiftly through the jungle on the trail of the departed Koronai. The three of us watched them vanish into the living night. Then, Besh and Chalk arranged themselves as comfortably as possible on the bunker floor, and I injected them with thanatazine. We all wait together, in hopes that Nick will win through the jungle, in hopes that he might find and bring back this Kar Vastor. This dangerous Lor Pelek, this terror of the living and mutilator of the dead, and that this man of no conscience or human feeling might use his power to save two lives. All I feel is the jungle and the dark. The eruption seems to be strengthening. And rain has begun, as it often will, triggered by particulates in the smoke plume. Speaking of smoke... Wait, that sounded like... Oh no, that's basic. Those are screams. There are children out there.
Mace pelted downslope, running half-blind through rain and smoke and steam, navigating by ear, heading for the screams. Mace threw himself into the Force, letting it carry him, bounding from rock to branch to rock, flipping high over crevices, slipping past black-shadowed tree trunks and under low branches with millimeters to spare. The voices came intermittently, in between, through the downpour and the eruption and the hammering of his own heart. Mace heard a grinding of steel on stone and the mechanical thunder of an engine pushed to the outer limits of its power. It was a steam crawler. It lay canted at a dangerous angle over a precipice, only a lip of rock preventing a fall into bottomless darkness. One track clanked on air. The other was buried in hardening lava. Though steam crawlers are low-tech, to reduce their vulnerability to the metal-eating fungi, they are far from primitive. A kilometer below the caldera, the lava flow didn't come close to the melting point of the advanced alloys that made up the steam crawler's armor and treads. But lava was filling in the gap below its flat undercarriage, until the only real question was whether the rising lava would topple the steam crawler over the lip before enough heat conducted through its armor to roast whoever was inside. But not everyone was inside. Mace skidded to a stop just a meter upslope of where the flow had cut the track. The lava had slashed through the ground to bedrock, making the edge of the gully where Mace stood into an unstable dirt cliff 8 meters high above a sluggish river of molten stone. The steam crawler was a further 10 meters down to his right. Its immense headlamps threw a white glare into the steam and the rain. Mace could just barely make out two small forms huddled together on the highest point, the rear corner of the cabin's heavily canted roof. Another crawled through the yellow-lit oblong of an open side hatch and joined them. 3 terrified children sobbing on the cabin roof. In the force, Mace could feel 2 more inside. 1 injured, in pain that was transforming into shock. The other, unconscious. A new tremor from the eruption shook the dirt cliff under his feet. He felt it sag. Undercut by the river of lava, the shaking was rapidly destroying the cliff's structural integrity. Any second now, it would collapse, sending Mace down into the river, unless he did something first. The something he did was to reach deep through the force until he could feel the dirt cliff's shatter point, a structure of broken rock 10 meters below him and 5 meters in from the face. He thought, why wait? And shoved. The dirt cliff shook, buckled, and collapsed. With a subterranean roar that buried even the thunder of the eruption and the clamor of the steam crawler's laboring engine, hundreds of tons of dirt and rock poured into the river of lava, organics bursting into flames that the growing landslide instantly smothered as it built itself into a huge wedge-shaped berm of raw ground across the gully. As lava slowly bulged and climbed the upstream face, the downstream side of the cliff continued to collapse, piling over cooler lava that hardened beneath it, pushing the hotter, more liquid lava into a wave that washed around the steam crawler's side, well to the lip of the precipice, then plunged in a rain of fire upon the black jungle far below. The landslide built into a wave of its own that filled in the gully as it rolled down toward the steam crawler and the screaming, sobbing children. And on the very crest of that wave of dirt and rock, backpedaling furiously to keep from being sucked under by the landslide's roll, came Mace Windu. Mace rode that crest, while the wave sank and flattened and finally lurched to a halt, its last remnants trickling into a ridge that joined Mace's position with the corner of the steam crawler's cabin. Nearly all his concentration stayed submerged in the force, spread throughout the slide, using a wide-focus force grip to stabilize the rubble while he scrambled down to the steam crawler's roof. On the roof were 2 young boys, both about 6, and a girl of perhaps 8 standard years. They clung to each other, sobbing, terror-filled eyes staring through their tears. Mace squatted beside them and touched the girl's arm.
My name is Mace Windu. I need your help.
The girl sniffled in astonishment.
My help?
Mace nodded gravely.
I need you to help me get these boys to safety. Can you do that? Can you take the boys up the same way I came down? Climb right up the crest. It's not steep.
I'm afraid.
Mace leaned close and spoke in her ear, only a little louder than the hush of the rain.
Me too. But you have to act brave. Pretend, so you don't scare the little boys. Okay?
Okay,
she said dubiously. But she wiped her eyes and took a deep breath. And when she turned to the other 2 children, her voice had the bossy edge that seems to be the exclusive weapon of 8-year-old girls.
Erno, Nykel, come on! Quit crying, you big babies! I'm going to save us!
As the girl bullied the 2 boys up onto the face of the slide, Mace moved on to the hatchway. Inside, the crawler's floor was sharply tilted, and the rain pounding through the open hatchway slickened the floor until it was impossible to climb. Down at the lowermost corner of the rectangular cabin, a boy who seemed to be barely into his teens struggled one-handed to drag a girl not much younger up the steep floor. He had a foamy wad of blood-soaked spray bandage around one upper arm, and he was trying to shove the unconscious girl ahead of him, using the riveted Durasteel leg posts of the crawler seats like a ladder. Mace leaned in through the hatchway and extended his hand.
All right, son, just take my hand. Once we get you out of here, then I can...
When the boy looked up, the tearful appeal on his face twisted into instant wild rage, and his plea became a fierce shriek. Mace hadn't noticed the swingstock blaster rifle slung around his good arm. The first hint of its existence Mace got was a burst of hot bolts past his face. He threw himself backward out the hatch and flattened against the cabin wall while the hatchway vomited blaster fire. The steam crawler lurched, the hatch going even higher. His sudden movement had been enough to tip its precarious balance, toppling it toward the precipice. Mace bared his teeth to the night. With the force, he seized the steam crawler and yanked it back into place. But a squeal from above grabbed his attention. In seizing the crawler, he'd lost his force hold on the landslide, and the unstable mound of dirt and rock had begun to shift under the little girl and the two boys, sending them sliding down toward the lava. Mace calmed his hammering heart and extended one hand. He had to close his eyes for a moment to reassert his control on the slide and stabilize it, but its shift had left it less solid than before. He could hold it for the minute or two it would take the girl and boys to reach the relative safety of the outcrop above, not much more. And now he could feel the crawler slowly tilting beneath him, leaning higher and higher toward the point of no return. From inside the cabin, he could hear the boys' terrified curses and his shrieks about, "Kill all you fraggin' cornos!" Mace's eyes drifted closed. This filthy war. The boy and the girl in the steam crawler were about to become casualties because when the boy had looked up, he could not see that the Jedi Master had come to his rescue. He could see only a Corrin. To use the Force to disarm the boy, or persuade him, would break the hold he kept upon the landslide, which might cost the lives of the three children scrambling up its face. To reason with the boy seemed impossible. The boy would know too much about what Balawai can expect at the hands of Koronai, and it would certainly take longer than they had. To abandon them was not an option. "Kid," Mace called, roughening his voice. Making himself sound the way the boy would expect a Corrin to sound, adopting a thick upland accent like Chalk's.
"Kid, 5 seconds to toss that blaster out the hatch and come after it, you got."
"Never," the boy screamed from inside. "Never."
"Don't come out, you, and the next thing you see, the last thing you see ever, is a grenade coming in. Hear me, you?"
"Go ahead. I know what happens if we get taken alive."
"Kid, already got the others, don't I? The girl, Erno and Nykel. Gonna lead them all alone, you? With me?"
There came a pause. Mace said into the silence,
"Sure, go ahead and die. Any coward can do that. Guts enough to live for a while, you got."
He was moderately sure that a 13-year-old boy who'd load up 4 other children and set out in a steam crawler across the Coronel Highland at night, a boy who'd rather die than leave an unconscious girl behind, had guts enough for just about anything. A second later, he was proved right.
From the private journals of Mace Windu.
"From this doorway, I can see a spray of brilliant white flares, headlamps of 4 steam crawlers, climbing the spine of the fold, heading for the broken track. Heading for us. Dawn will come in an hour. I hope we'll all live that long. The eruptions have subsided, and the rain has trailed off to an intermittent patter. We've shifted some things around in the bunker. The 3 younger children are curled up on scavenged blankets in the back, asleep. Besh and Chalk now lie near the Thunderbolt, where I can keep an eye on them. I'm not at all sure that one of these children might not try to do them some harm. Terrell, a boy of 13 who seems to be their natural leader, is remarkably fierce, and he still does not entirely believe that I'm not planning to torture all 5 of them to death. I wonder what Nick would say about these civilians. Are they a myth, too? I can't consider such questions right now. Right now, all I seem to be able to do is stare past the twisted jags of durasteel that once had been this bunker's door, watching the steam crawler's upward creep. I don't need any hints from the Force to have a bad feeling about this. In Dejarik, there is a classic maneuver called the Fork, where a player moves a single hollow monster into position to attack 2 or more of his opponents, so that no matter which monster the opponent moves to safety, the other will be eaten. Caught in the Fork, one's only choice is which piece to lose. The word has come to symbolize situations where the only choice to be made is a choice of disasters. We are well and truly forked. I know who these steam crawlers are bringing. Jungle prospectors from the same outpost as the children.
fleeing the same ULF guerrillas whose attack had forced the children away. Probably the same band that destroyed this outpost. I got the story from Terrell while I was tending to his broken arm and the girl's scalp wound. Terrell's arm had been broken by either a bullet or a grenade fragment. He wasn't sure which. The older girl, Keela, has the most serious injury. In the steam crawler's tumble down the gully, she had been thrown from her seat. She has a skull fracture and a severe concussion. The younger children, Erno and Nykel, and the brave little girl, Pell, have nothing worse than a few bruises and scraped hands and knees from scrambling up the landslide. I have not bothered to maintain my pretense of belonging to the guerrillas, though I have also avoided explaining who I really am. The children seem to have decided that I'm a bounty hunter, since I don't act like a Corno, which is to say, I haven't tortured and killed them, as they were all half expecting, based on the tales they've heard from their parents. I have not disabused them of this notion. It's easier to believe than the truth. The line of steam crawlers has halted half a kilometer below us, where the lava wash has taken out the track. This won't stop them for long. When the cliff collapsed, it made a natural dam across the break. It seems I have no choices left. Surrender is not an option. To save Besh and Chalk, not to mention myself, I'll have to hold the children hostage. This is how far I've fallen. Even I, a Jedi Master. This is what a few days in this war has brought me to, threatening the lives of children I would give my own to save. And if these Balawai call my bluff, the best outcome I can then foresee, these children will have to watch as their parents or their parents' friends are killed by a Jedi. Glow rods below. They've left the steam crawlers and are advancing on foot. There are a lot of them.
These Balawai may have been irregulars, but they were both experienced and disciplined. Their recon squad entered the ruined compound in three teams of two, spread over 120 degrees of arc to give them overlapping fields of fire. While glow rods still waved halfway along the slope below, these six entered in total silence and deep shadow. They must have had some kind of night vision equipment. If the Force hadn't let Mace feel the stark threat of their weapons' points of aim, he wouldn't have known they were there.
Terrell, he said softly, they're here. Go ahead, son.
You sure? I can't see anything, Terrell said from beside him.
They will be able to see you, Mace said. Call out.
Okay.
Staying in the shadows, he repeated okay, but this time in a loud call.
Okay. Hey, don't shoot, okay? Don't shoot, it's me.
The night went silent. Mace felt six weapons trained on the bunker door. He murmured,
tell them who you are.
Yeah, hey, listen, it's Terrell, huh? Terrell Nakai. Is my dad out there?
A woman's voice came out of the darkness to Mace's left, shrill with hope.
Terrell, oh my God, Terrell, is Keela with you?
The girl with the head wound held Pell and the two boys well back from the doorway. But when she heard the woman's voice, she started unsteadily to her feet.
Mom, I'm here. I'm okay. Keela, oh my God, is Pell with you?
A man shouted from the center.
Quiet!
Rankin, it's Terrell and Keela. Didn't you hear them? Keela, what about Pell?
Hold your damn position and shut up,
the man snarled. His voice was ragged, angry, exhausted, and desperate.
They could be bait. Shut your hole before I shoot you myself.
Mace nodded to himself. He would have suspected the same thing.
Terrell?
The man called out in a much softer tone, wearily calm.
Terrell, it's Peck Rankin. Come on out here where we can see you.
Terrell looked at Mace.
Go on then, Mace said gently. Move slowly. Keep your hands in plain sight, away from your body.
Terrell did.
Can somebody put on a light? I can't see.
In a minute,
Rankin's voice replied from the darkness.
Just keep walking toward my voice. Are you alone? Where are the other kids?
In the bunker, but they can't come out.
Terrell said. And you can't go in.
Why's that?
Mace said, because I'm in here.
In the Force, he felt their tension ratchet up, sharp as an indrawn breath. After a moment, Rankin's voice came out of the darkness.
And who might you be?
You don't need to know.
Is that so? Why don't you step out where we can get a look at you?
Because the temptation to take a shot at me might prove overwhelming. Any bolts that miss will be bouncing around the inside of this bunker, where there are four more innocent children. A new man's voice rang out from the right, thin with fear and anger.
Two of those kids are my sons, if you hurt them.
All I have done, Mace said, is tend their injuries and keep them sheltered. What happens to them now depends on you.
He's telling the truth, Terrell called. He didn't hurt us. He saved us. He's okay, really. He's just afraid you'll shoot him because he's a corno.
A burst of low, half-strangled profanity came from the right. Terrell called hastily.
But he's not a real corno. He just looks like one. He talks almost like a regular balawai, and he's like a bounty hunter or something.
His voice trickled off, leaving a silence empty and ominous. Finally, Rankin called out once more.
So, what do you want?
I want you to take these children and go away from here.
Huh? What else?
That's all. Just take the children and go.
Well, aren't you generous? Rankin said, dry, bitter. Listen, I'm gonna make a light. Nobody get twitchy. I don't want to get fragged, okay?
Yellow-white glow flared behind a slab of tumbled wall, and a cell-powered glow rod came flipping through the air to land not far from Terrell's feet. Terrell held a hand at his chin to shade his eyes.
Hey, don't make me stand around alone out here, huh?
Come on over here, boy.
A man stepped into view, moving slowly into the light. He held a blaster rifle in one hand, its barrel slanting down, carefully directed at the ground beside him. From his voice, this was Rankin.
Get yourself under cover.
Terrell looked back up at the bunker. May said,
Go ahead, son.
The voice of the man who claimed to be the boy's father snarled from the darkness.
Don't call him son, Corno. You're not his father. Your stinking kind killed his father.
Stow that crap,
Rankin barked, but too late. Terrell's face crumpled in tragic disbelief.
Dad?
He said, sounding stunned and lost.
My dad?
If eyes could shoot blaster bolts, Rankins would have killed the man.
Get him out of here, he said.
Another man, also wounded, stepped far enough into the light to fold Terrell in his arms and draw him away into the ring of darkness.
Listen, Rankin said, looking up at the dark, jagged mouth of the bunker. Those crawlers are stuffed with wounded, and we've got a cartload of cornos on our tails. We can't just go, get it? We can't. We need a place to hole up till dawn, that's all.
You can't stay here, May said. There are ULF guerrillas on their way here right now. Look at where you are. This place couldn't stand against them when it was intact.
You know what happened here?
Rankin waved his rifle at the shattered huts.
Where is everybody?
Dead, May said. Killed by the ULF. All of them.
I don't think so. Where are the bodies? Think I've never seen a ULF action? I know the kind of things they do to our dead.
Forget the bodies.
Mace had buried them all. He tried to massage the pain from his temple with the heel of one hand.
If you're here when the gorillas arrive, they'll kill all of you, too. You care about your children's lives? Get them out of here.
Some kind of stinking funny corno,
the father's voice said from the shadows.
What's he so worried about us for?
Didn't I tell you to shut up?
Rankin snapped.
You're asking us to take a lot on faith from some guy we can't even see.
You don't need to see me. All you need is to see this.
With a twitch of the Force, Mace squeezed the Thunderbolt's trigger. A single packet of plasma screamed into the sky and burst in a spherical flash of scarlet as it entered a low cloud.
That could as easily have been your head. I know exactly where you are. All six of you.
He paused for a second, to let that sink in.
If I wanted you hurt, we wouldn't be talking. You'd already be dead.
The truth of this wiped Rankin's face clean of expression. Mace watched it hit home and had just enough time to think that this might actually work. Then, streaks of blaster fire lit up the slope below. The jungle thundered with scarlet explosions, multiple bolts flashing from the cover of steam crawlers to shatter branches and blow rocks to splinters. The bursts were instantly echoed by smaller, wider flares under the trees, crackling like a bonfire built of green logs. Muzzle flashes. Slug throwers.
Rankin!
The Force gave Mesa's voice the thunder of a signal cannon.
Pull your people back! A fighting retreat! Have them pull back here to the compound!
You said coming up here can't help us.
It can't. I can. Do it. It's your only chance.
Behind Mace, one of the boys had started to cry, and now the other one joined him. Outside, Rankin was shouting into his comlink.
No, damn it, up here! Flares and flame projectors! Light them up and slow them down! And get those crawlers in gear!
A star burst to life below and shot high into the air. A flare. It hung below the clouds, lighting the steam crawlers, the jungle, and the outpost stark actinic white. Mace had to shield his eyes against the sudden glare, and he heard the father's harsh cry of triumph, and the Force snapped his lightsaber to his hand and brought the blade to life as a blaster rifle sang a rhythm fast as a hand could squeeze. The father was no marksman. No bolt would have come within arm's length of Mace, but they would have bounced into the bunker. Amethyst energy flashed to meet the red, and instead, every bolt screamed away into the sky. Mace stood in the doorway, looking down at Rankin's awestruck face past the guard angle of his lightsaber's blade. Rankin's mouth moved in breathless silence.
Jedi!
Keela,
Mace said without turning, his voice tight but dead level.
Get the children to the back. Lie down behind the bodies of the Koronai. They are your best cover.
What?
Keela stared at him blankly.
Who are you?
From outside, the father's voice roared.
That's a Jedi!
And an instant later, it was joined by another voice, higher, half-broken, hoarse with grief, betrayal, and wild rage.
A stinking Jedi! He's a stinking Jedi! Kill him! Kill him!
The voice was Terrell's. The Force moved Mace's hands faster than thought. Deepa's lightsaber went to his left hand to mirror his own in his right, and together they wove a wall across the mouth of the bunker, catching and scattering a flood of blaster fire. Mace sank deeper and deeper into the Force, surrendering more and more of his conscious thought to instinctive whirl of the Vapad. And even so, some bolts slipped past him and whanged randomly around the inside of the bunker. He was aware, in an abstract, disconnected way, of an ache.